Hi, I am Craig F. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. Recovered in mind and spirit, but not quite yet in body. I live in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I had this vision that there'd be a full room and we would do the wave to get everyone started, to get everybody alert and get the little oxygen pumping, but, you know, you all look alert, so we may pass on the wave. I'm going to start with a couple of stories, and then I'll get back to tying those in later on. The first story I want to tell, and anybody that's ever heard me talk knows I tell this story a lot, but because it's one of my favorites. I feel like I'm overpowering the mic. Okay. All right, great. The story starts like this. A guy walks into a meeting late, and he sits down, and he leans up, and there's an old-timer sitting there, and he says to the old-timer, he says, "What's the topic today?" And the old-timer says, "The topic's surrender and acceptance." And so the guy listens for a while, and he leans back up to the old-timer and he says, "The topic's not surrender and acceptance. They're not talking about surrender and acceptance." And the old-timer says, "The topic's always surrender and acceptance. They just haven't gotten around to it yet." And so, since the topic of this whole convention is acceptance, I thought that would be a good story to lead out with. I'm going to tell you a little bit of my story just to give you an idea of who I am. I was born a compulsive overeater, but I was born willful. My dad says that the first time he ever saw me, I was walking down the corridor at the hospital out of the living room, smoking a cigar and flirting with the nurses. Depending on who he was telling it to, he'd say walking, smoking a cigar and pinching the nurses on the butt. But usually he'd tone it down to flirting with the nurses. Although that's probably a little bit of an exaggeration, I was a pretty willful child. And I don't mean willful like temper tantrum willful. What I mean by that is that I had the idea that somehow I could control circumstances around me by the force of my will. That I was somehow crafty enough and smart enough that I could outsmart everything in my life. I started drinking alcoholically at 15, and I drank that way until I was 39. I never had a DUI, and I thought that was because I was smarter than everybody else. You know, I look back now and know that God takes care of fools and drunks, and I was both. But, you know, I also thought that... I'm have an architectural degree and an engineering degree, and I work in the construction industry, and I chewed a superintendent out one time because he let it rain on his job. Now, you know, I caught myself in mid-sentence and realized that was insane, and so I covered it by saying, well, if you'd have really been on the ball, you would have been ready for the rain. You would have made that pour earlier. You would have dug some ditches, sort of drain off. You know, I know you can't control the rain, but in my mind, I really felt like that if I just willed it not to rain, that I could pretty well stave it off, you know? Now, that's an ego that is, but that ego, you know, there's a description of addicts as egomaniacs with low self-esteem, and that's me. You know, I had that willful personality, that hard-charging personality, but underneath was the fear that I wouldn't get my way, and you know, that I wasn't enough to get my way. I missed a story that I meant to tell. When I was about 3 years old, I had an older brother that was 2.5 years older than me, and we lived in this house that had a malfunctioning door into a bedroom, and we'd gotten in the bedroom and the door had shut and locked, and we were locked in this bedroom. And when my mother found us, my little fists were bloody from beating on the door trying to get out. And I wasn't beating on the door to get her attention. I was beating on the door to beat it down, to get out. My brother, that was 2.5 years older than me, was sitting on the floor sobbing. He was just crying, you know. He was passive, aggressive, and passive anyway. And, you know, his solution was to sit there and cry and wait for the world to save him. And mine was to beat that door down, you know. And that's how I approached everything in my life for a lot of years. And, you know, it worked for a long time. It worked in a lot of ways. I got a lot of what I wanted doing that. You know, I have an architectural degree, and I'm probably the worst artist in this room. You know, I willed my way through college. I made my points where I could make my points. I learned to draw, to draft. But, you know, I just felt like I could charge hard enough, I could get anything done that I needed to get done. So that's how I lived my life. And unfortunately, though, there were things that wouldn't bend to my will. And one of them, ironically, was this disease. You know, no matter what I did, I kept seeming to gain weight, you know. And I would try, I tried everything, you know. I tried pain ways. I tried Weight Watchers 3 times. I tried cabbage soup cleanses. I tried every diet that I knew to try, and I'd lose a little weight and I'd gain it back. Went to the diet doctor and got the hormone shots to steal from the urine of pregnant women, and the amphetamines and the vitamin B shots, and I lost 50 pounds in about a month and a half, and, you know, good stuff, good for your health. And so, anyway, but no matter how willful I got about it, it got worse, you know? No matter how hard I charged at it, it was something I couldn't beat. You know, I couldn't make it bend to my will, this food thing, and I didn't understand that. And so, anyway, life went on, and, you know, and I always saw life as a series of acquisitions. You know, you got married, you got kids, you got an education, maybe not all in that order, you got a career, you got money, a home, you acquired stuff in life, right? You charged hard and you built this life. I got to program and somebody said life is a series of necessary losses, and I thought, you idiot. You just don't know how to hold on to things, but I didn't know how to hold on to things. You know, life is a series of necessary losses, and sometimes we have to learn how to grieve those losses, and sometimes what we have to do is realize that we're powerless over certain things in our lives. I'm powerless over food. My life's unmanageable by me. So anyway, I made and lost two fortunes in my 30s. And to me, a fortune is I had over $1 million cash in the bank. That's enough of a fortune. You know, somebody may think that's not enough to be called a fortune, but coming from my roots, that was doing good. And I wanted to blame everybody in the world but me, but I'd gone through that. I'd gotten married early. When I was 19, she was 17, she was pregnant. You got married, you know. And she miscarried on our wedding night. We stayed married. We soldiered on, you know. And so I went through this insanity of these 20 years as I look back on it, where my weight went from being I was a really good athlete in high school. I was a good basketball player and good football player, played baseball and ran track, and I was in really good shape. And I went from that to slowly getting up to over 400 pounds. And, you know, with enough body, dysmorphia to think that I looked okay. Maybe I did, I don't know. But, No, I'm kidding. I'm about 39, and I'd lost that second business, and I was traveling a lot in order to make the kind of money that I thought I needed in order to live. And I'd come home. I was basically gone all the time, except I'd come home one weekend a month for a long weekend and pretend like I was married. And I came home this one weekend, and we'd been fighting, and we knew it was getting close to the end. And I came home this one weekend, and my wife took me back to the airport and handed me a letter. And the letter said, I want a divorce. I went out. And it was no big loss to me. I wanted out of that marriage, too. But, you know, it's torture for both of you to be in a marriage like that when you don't really know how to love, let alone love one another. But I'd been to one OA meeting already because a counselor told me, I'd lied to him about my drinking, but I couldn't lie about my eating. And he told me to start going to OA and come back see him in a year when I was ready to be honest with him. And a lot of people about get hit in my story, you know. But anyway, so I agreed to do that, and I'd been to one meeting already. And this day that I got on this airplane in Phoenix, because that's where the family lived, and I was headed back to Pennsylvania because that's where I was working. And so I got on this airplane and I started to fly, and I sat there and read that letter, and I realized how bankrupt my life was, you know, spiritually, morally, physically, financially, that all those things that I thought that this willful, skillful, finagling person that I saw myself as was all dust, you know, it had all fallen apart. And I was broken. And so I went to my second OA meeting that night when I got back. And, you know, those flying days were drinking days and eating days for me because I didn't have anywhere to be or anything to do. And, you know, I didn't get the detail, but it's, I got back sober and had meeting all day and went to a meeting and got a sponsor that night. And I'd like to tell you that 28 years ago, I'm going to sit down, that was 28 years ago and that I'm still abstinent, but I can't tell you that. It's not true. I'm going to have to play with that microphone again. My leg's starting to cramp a little bit. I needed the stool after all. Thank you. All right. Thank you. All right. Here we go. But so I got back to Allentown, and I went to that meeting. I got a sponsor, and I started working the program as I understood it, and it still had an awful lot of self-will in it. You know, I heard people that go to meetings make it, meeting makers make it, and I was doing an AA meeting at noon and an OA meeting in the evening every day of the week. And then I was going with some people to an AA meeting every Friday night, and then sometimes there was other meetings thrown in. I mean, I was literally getting over two meetings a day. And I had a sponsor. He gave me what they used to call the Westminster questions to work the steps. There were 32 questions, and when you finished them, you'd work the first three steps. And I asked him, I remember asking him that first night, now there's 12 steps here. I said, how long is it supposed to take me? You know, like 12 days? You know, because I'm competitive. And, you know, if it's supposed to take 12 days, I'm going to do it in 8 and show you how good I am. And he said, slow down. We'll just do this as it comes. And so I got through those, and we got to that fourth step, and he relapsed. And there wasn't another male sponsor around, so I got a female sponsor, which is a whole other story, because I got the girl I was attracted to, you know, and we ended up, well, you know, It's just not the best way. And so anyway, I got to that first step and I started to stall. And the reason I started to stall was I knew that if I put things on that first step that I'd have to make amends for them when I got to that ninth step. You know, that there were certain things that I wasn't, my ego wasn't ready to let me admit to. And there were certain things that in that ninth step that I knew I was not going to make amends for. And I added to that list in program. After a year in program, I lost 145 pounds that first year in program. I went from 410 down to 260, and I'm a big bone guy, and 260 is getting pretty close to high school playing weight. And I was feeling my oats and sowing those oats. So I moved from there to Tulsa, and when I got to Tulsa, I met somebody that I thought was the love of my life, met him in program, and we're still the best of friends, but we're not in a relationship. She got pregnant. I've got three sons now, and but her husband thought it was his child. I mean, that's as terrible as that sounds, you know. And I did that sober and abstinent in program. And now I have another story, another secret that I won't share with anybody, right? How can I tell that secret, right? How can I make amends for that? And so now I'm hiding from God. I spent the week with my four-year-old, three-and-a-half-year-old granddaughter, my only granddaughter, that lives here in town, and she likes to take her clothes off and run around naked, you know, and my son says, I don't know, we're not quite sure how to handle this because we don't want to put a complex on her, you know, make her feel bad. But, you know, apparently there was guys there working on their koi pond the other day, and she running around dancing in the window naked, you know. And, you know, there's time and a place for that, young lady. But, you know, what I thought about was that thing in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, where Adam and Eve cover themselves with fig leaves, and God says, "Who told you you were naked?" You know, like, who put that shame and guilt on you? And you know, it's a tough thing. And I think that when we get down to, we get down here in a second to the spiritual experience, one of the problems is God's always right there for me. He's always been right there for me. It's my guilt and shame that separates me from God. And so when I refuse to admit to certain things, and when I refuse to make amends for those things, it's that guilt, it's that ego that separates me from God. God never moves. He's right there. But I separate myself from God in those things I wouldn't let go of. So anyway, I couldn't get through the steps. I couldn't find the right sponsor. I spent 6 months one time looking for the right book and the right pen to do a fourth step, you know, because I have to write. And I had all the warnings. I had a man, I listened to a speaker that had sobered up at Dr. Bob's house back in the good old days. And this was in the 90s, and the guy was so old that he was blind, and somebody had to hold him up to the microphone. And he talked about coming in on a Thursday, and he drank on Thursday, and he came to his first meeting on a Friday at Dr. Bob's house. And when the meeting was over, they took him to the back of the room, and they said, "We assume that you know your power is over alcohol and your life's unmanageable, or you wouldn't be here." And he said, "Yeah, that's true." And they said, "So do you think God can restore you to sanity?" And he says, "Yeah, I believe that." And they said, "Will you pray with us?" And they prayed the third step prayer. And he said, then they took out a bar napkin and a ink pen, and they said, "So what have you done wrong?" And he said, "I told this lie and that lie and this lie," and they wrote liar on the napkin. And he said, I stole this, I stole that, and I stole this," and they wrote thief on the napkin. And he said, it went like that for a while, and when he got it all out, They said, now why did you do those things? And he talked about, he got around to understanding that he told those lies to make himself look better, and he stole things because he was jealous of what people had. And he got to the causes and conditions, and so they prayed with him and asked God to remove those character defects. And they made a list of the people he'd harmed. And on this Friday night, Saturday, he was out on the street making amends to people, and he'd been sober ever since. And I'm sitting there, having spent the last 6 months looking for a pen and a paper, the right pencil and paper to do my fourth step, realizing that, you know, I wasn't looking for the right pencil and paper. I was bargaining. I was trying to figure out how to write those things down so I wouldn't look so bad. You know, I was trying to figure out a way to write those things down so that I could protect my fragile ego. And I wish I could tell you again that that was enough of a revelation to really start working the steps. But shortly after that, this love of my life decided that I wasn't the correct gender for her. And I had to deep down, dig down and say, do I love this woman or not? And if the answer is yes, and it was, I had to say to her, I just want you to be happy and walk away. And I did that, but I didn't do that without feeling more pain than I thought I was capable of experiencing. And, you know, at that point, you either have a spiritual way of life and a spiritual program, or you eat. And, you know, eating is a step up from the morass of that pain. And I'm not, you know, I don't blame that on anybody at all. I don't mean to sound like it's her fault that I ate. I don't. She made her choice. And it's apparently the right choice for her. But for me, I made a choice, and my choice was to go back out and eat. And I gained all that weight back and a bonus. And I tried geographical cures, you know. I moved from Tulsa to Las Vegas. I moved from Las Vegas to Arkansas, of all places, and then to Western Kansas for the company that I ended up working for in Tulsa, and then back to Tulsa. And I got up to 520 pounds in all that shifting around and not being anchored in to a program, not even having the meeting habits anymore, because I'm moving. No, they're not there. 520 pounds, this son that I had with this lady in Tulsa, by then he'd grown up. He very proud of him. He played college football and he had a chance to go pro, and he's a big guy, 6'5 and a half, and, you know, bench press 450 pounds. That'll come up here in a second. But anyway, I was riding with him to a restaurant to celebrate his birthday, and I asked him to move 20 feet closer to the door of the restaurant because it would make it easier to walk into the restaurant to have dinner with him and the family. And he started to cry. That's tough. And he was crying because he thought I was going to kill myself with this food. You know, he could see I was about to kill myself. 520 pounds, you're cutting your life expectancy down on a daily basis. And I didn't know what to do. You know, I really didn't know what to do. And this friend of mine said, his mother said she was doing this program that had a lot of requirements, and it was working for her. And I said, okay, I'll give that a try. And, you know, I'm still willful, and I made that program work. You know, it was a see how thing. And I made it work for a while. I lost 150 pounds. You know, still not down to playing weight, but I'm making it work. I'm on their phone meetings. I've got a sponsor. One thing about it is that he gave me one question a day. We're back to the one question a day. And willful that I am, without a spiritual experience, I can't stay abstinent. Without that connection to that power greater than myself, sooner or later, life's going to catch up with me, and I'm going to eat again. And, you know, and I share that, and I want to be careful, because sometimes I share strongly, and that may or may not apply to you. I don't know. You have to identify or not identify with that. I get kind of evangelical sometimes, and I just want to not want to step in anybody else's path. But so anyway, I relapsed again, and I'd gotten down to about 350, and in that relapse, I got up to 460. This analogous relapse, and you know, I got up to go to work one morning, and I sat down in my, and I have an easy chair in my bedroom, and I sat down in the easy chair or my dressing chair to get dressed, and I didn't have the strength of my legs to stand up. And I didn't know what was wrong. I just knew I didn't feel good. I couldn't stand. And I tried for some hard-headed here. I'm still a little boy beating these bloody fists on that door. I tried to stand up out of that chair for like 3 hours without calling. I had a cell phone in my hand, but I didn't call for help, you know. And finally, after 3 hours, I thought, I know, I'll roll out of the chair down on the floor, crawl over to the bed, and pull myself up on the bed. And in my mind, if I can get up and stand up and get dressed, I'll go on and go to work. All of it seems so insane to me today. But I got down on the floor and I couldn't get up on the bed. Now I'm on the floor and I've got the cell phone. And so I called that son, and because he's big guy, right? Strong guy. Said, come on over here to the house and help me. I'm on the floor and I can't get up. And that alarmed him. So he called his mother. His mother called me and said, if you're too weak to get up off the floor, you're going to the hospital. Are you calling or am I? Well, I'm still pretty hard-headed and you don't tell me what to do, right? And so I said, I'll call him. So I did. And six big firemen came and they put a tarp down, and this is humiliating, but I need to be transparent. They put a tarp down on the bedroom floor and they rolled me under the tarp and they picked it up and they put me on a gurney and they took me to the hospital. And the doctor says, you've got a septic infection in the lymphedema in your legs, and we're going to have to keep you here 3 weeks on IV antibiotics. And I said, you don't understand, I'm an important person where I work, and I don't have 3 weeks. I said, just put a PICC line in and give me the bags, and I'll change the bags every day, you know, every 4 hours or 6 hours, whatever you tell me to do, and just let me out of here. I need to get to work. I got jobs to bid. And she said, you don't understand. She said, if we don't do this right, you got about a 25% chance of dying in the next 3 weeks. And she said, even if we do it right, you got a 40% chance of losing your legs at the knees in 6 weeks if the antibiotics don't work. Well, I'm hard-headed, but I'm not that hard-headed. So everybody left me, and I laid there in that bed. And here's the thing. I've been I've been in this program long enough to know where the solution was, you know, and to have a pretty good idea what the solution is. And I lay there in that bed and I cried out to God, and I knew, you know, I knew what I'd done to myself. And I cried out and I said, God, whatever it takes, whatever I have to do, whatever I have to confess to, whatever I have to make amends for, just show me, just help me, just help me, because I'm all in. I'm out of ideas. I'm out of options. I'm out of everything. I'm yours. And that same woman, the love of the one I thought was the love of my life, and the one that the mother of the youngest child was doing an online big book study now, and she'd already given me the phone numbers and suggested that that would be a good place to find some help. And so I made that call, called into that meeting the next morning, and I got a sponsor that next morning. And I got a hardcore, hard-ass sponsor. And I started working the steps. And, you know, I was in the hospital 3 weeks, and I was making amends when I got out of the hospital. And I didn't hold back. I had to make amends that I thought I'd never make, including making an amends to her husband, you know, including making amends to the other children that were involved. You know, I had to do those things. I had to be transparent. I had to own up to my willfulness and my lack of humility, my lack of acceptance. And when I did those things, every time I did one of those things, it was like a weight came off my shoulders. And I don't mean a physical weight, I mean a spiritual, emotional weight. And I felt closer to that God that I had tried to pray to and tried to get close to, but couldn't, because I didn't even want God to see some of those things. You know, I know He sees them, but I didn't want Him to. And I had that spiritual experience, you know, that the program promises. And with that spiritual experience, I got those promises in steps 10 and 11 in the big book. The freedom from food obsession, the neutrality around food came to pass in my life. And I could see it happening, and I could see the difference. And I got through those steps, and you know, I've sat in enough OA meetings and AA meetings in my life to have earned 3 or 4 PhDs if I'd have done that, you know, doing college credits. But, you know, knowledge won't save your butt, you know. Roland Hazard, and There's a Solution, worked with Dr. Young, and Dr. Young had led him through for a year, and he said he thought he knew the wellsprings of his mind well enough that he'd never have to drink again, and yet he went to Paris from Austria and drank a bottle of champagne to celebrate his newfound sobriety. And, you know, and was back to Dr. Young, and Dr. Young told him that he was hopeless unless he had this spiritual rearrangement. And, you know, I can't begin to tell you how much different my life is today, how much different I am. You know, people say, talk to, you know, so you have a gentle demeanor, you don't know me. I'm the guy that almost hit 3 or 4 different sponsors because they said things I didn't like, you know. I'm the little kid that beat his fist bloody on the door to try to get out of that room. And I remember that kid. I remember that me. But there is a difference today, and that difference today is the presence of God in my life, the presence of God in me. Now I'm going to try to come back and tie all that into reentry. You know, we're I don't know, how am I doing on time? Good. Okay.
It's 11:35.
All right. Well, good. So we've all been here at this conference all weekend, most of us all weekend, and we've shared a lot of great things, and now we're getting ready to go back to our normal lives, our regular lives. I don't know how normal our lives are, but to our regular lives. You know, I have friends that refuse to go to conferences and conventions and retreats because reentry is hard for them sometimes. And the reason it's hard for them is we get here among ourselves and we share and we have this camaraderie, this fellowship, and when we go back, we're going back to people that don't have that. You know, there's not that transparency, and there's not that level of acceptance and surrender. And I'm going to tell you that, you know, I'm going to go back to that story of the old-timer that said the topic is all surrender and acceptance, and to tell you that there's truth in that, but there's a greater truth, because there is something to discuss beyond surrender and acceptance. But, you see, if I can surrender, I can. Step one says that I admitted I was a compulsive overeater and my life's unmanageable. That's, you know, that's acceptance. I can have that acceptance. I can believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. And step two, and that's still just acceptance. And in step three, I can make a decision to turn my will and life over to the care of God as I understand God. And that is surrender. So I've got acceptance and I've got surrender. But I don't have recovery yet when I've done that. You know, step three is best described as a decision to go ahead and work the rest of the steps, right? And so if I'm saying that I'm going to, faith without works is dead, you know, surrender and acceptance without works, without doing the work, you know, my brother sitting in that room when I'm beating my fists on the door, he'd surrendered. You know, he was sitting on the floor crying. He'd surrendered. He'd accepted the fact that we were locked in that room, and he'd surrendered, and he was crying. And, you know, I hadn't accepted or surrendered, but neither one of us were getting anywhere, you know. I have to surrender and accept, and then I have to take the right action. You know, and the right action is that I have to engage in these principles. I have to learn these steps. I have to practice these steps, and I have to get to where I'm capable of living a spiritual way of life, where I'm capable of living life on life's terms or life on God's terms on a minute-by-minute daily basis. I sponsor a lot of men now. I'm down to 9. I've been as high as 12. It works for me. I have the time. And I call myself a cheerleader for prayer. You know, that 90% of what I do is say, have you prayed about that? Have you surrendered that? You know, I need a little tape, a little cassette tape. Just hit the button that says, have you prayed about that? Have you surrendered about that? You know, they'll text me something, and the little prayer emoji is worn out on my phone. No. Because what we're learning how to do in this program so much is to accept life on life's terms, to learn to ask God not the Santa Claus God, but God, how can I be of service to you and others today? So as we're going to re-enter our lives, our regular lives, whether you're going back to a home that's full of family and friends, or whether you're going back like me to two dogs that are ornery, I have to go back with the idea that I'm going back on God's terms, that I've surrendered, that I've accepted, that I'm ready to live this, get to the most important word in the steps is in the 12th step. And it says, having had a spiritual awakening as, and here it is, it's the most important word in the steps, as the result of these steps, not a result, not maybe you'll have one, maybe you won't, but having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we sought to carry this message to other compulsive overeaters and what? Practice these principles in all our affairs. And so when we're going back to deal with these people that haven't been here sharing this convention with us, we're going back to practice these principles in all our affairs. And you know, I've seen people, when you go back, they think you've been here on vacation all weekend, you know, and they've had maybe a little extra responsibility, maybe not, to care for the kids or care for the dogs or do whatever, you know, and there's some resentment there. And, you know, we come back from these things usually tired because we've been up or we're emotionally drained or whatever. And our view of what just happened for the last 3 days is different than the one we left behind. And so maybe a solution to that is to stop between now and home and pray and say, you know, what can I do to be of service? Show me, God, what I can do to be of service to those at my home when I get home today. You know, divorce me, remove me from the bondage of self, that selfishness, self-centeredness, self-will that can block me from being of service to you and others today. Maybe a simple prayer like that, a simple attitude adjustment, instead of saying, you know, I'm gonna get home and exert my will, or I'm gonna get home and by God, I hope they kept the house clean. We stop a minute and say, how can I be of service to them? How can I be of understanding of their needs today? You know, that's a good prayer for any day of the week. You know, how can I be of service to those around me and show God's love, be a conduit of mercy and love and tolerance today? And if I do that, I can maybe have a chance of maintaining that spiritual experience. You know, there's going to be people like me that are going home to two dogs or no dogs or whatever. And, you know, so I ask myself, how can I be of service to somebody else outside my home, you know? Because if I go home to isolation, then I... You know, this is just, use the right word here. This is just fooling myself. You know, learning all this program is an academic exercise if I can't take it and be of service to God and others. You know, so there's ways to do that. You know, we can take phone numbers from here, you know, get a lot of phone numbers. Stay in touch with some of the people that you've met here over the next few days. You know, keep your tribe together. Thank you, Jen, for that thought. You know, I've got a 10-hour drive, like she said, ahead of me this afternoon, and I love road trips, and that's not a terrible thing for me. But I have most of my sponsorees lined up to call me at certain times on that drive, and as long as I have cell phone service, because it breaks the drive up, and because I can talk program to somebody on the way home. I'm not going to feel that isolation, that vacuum that happens after you leave a retreat and you leave all these wonderful people behind. And so there's things like that that we have to be deliberate about, I believe. You know, I have to be deliberate about a lot of things in my life. I have to be deliberate about prayer. I have to be deliberate about my daily inventory. I have to be deliberate about staying in contact with the people that that feed me and that I get to feed back and forth. You know, nothing so much will assure your continued sobriety as working with others, as it says in Working with Others. Big book, that was redundant. But so anyway, all weekend we've heard, I think, a few times, somebody read from the acceptance chapter, but they've read the acceptance is the key earlier in the chapter. But the very last two paragraphs I want to read as my closing Acceptance is the key to my relationship with God today. I never just sit and do nothing while waiting for Him to tell me what to do. Rather, I do whatever is in front of me to be done, and I leave the results up to Him, however it turns out. That's God's will for me. I must keep my magic magnifying mind on my acceptance and off my expectations, for my serenity is directly proportional to my level of acceptance. When I remember this, I can see I've never had it so good. Thank God for AA. With that, I pass. Thank you.